We are talking today with Carol Brightman. She is author of the book Total Insecurity, The Myth of American Omnipotence. Carol, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
If you could begin, tell us what the motivation was in writing your book.
Well, it started, it was a summer, late summer of 2002, and I knew the war was happening. It was coming up. I sniffed it out. I mean, I was involved in, I edited a magazine in the 60s called Viet Report, which was about Vietnam. And even though I haven't had, you know, much to do with that sort of stuff for a long time, I really sensed that this, a big one was coming. And so a friend of mine, a sort of friend of mine who I hadn't seen in 35 years, we were in email contact, and we were discussing something about how the 60s was dealt with in the media. I was reviewing a book for the LA Times. And so I mentioned, he said, why don't you write a book about that? Well, that was the beginning of this project, and this was Tarek Ali, who's the editorial. Do you know him?
We air his talks on our station.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, he's the editorial director of Verso, which is the London publisher. So, and he and I went to North Vietnam in 1967, a long time ago. And we hadn't seen each other then. We were just in touch. And then he wanted me to write a book about American descent, the rise of, the return of American descent. And I didn't really feel that was happening. But I was more interested in the true nature of the national security strategy and what Bush was up to and what the motivations for Iraq were, because I knew it wasn't weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I knew that even before I really knew why I knew that. And I also knew it, there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Well, I was following the press and I was online and so on. So I figured it was oil, but that was kind of crude, pardon the pun. And I thought, so they want to get in there directly because they want to have a direct control of where the oil goes. Not, they just don't want it for themselves. They want to determine the transit, the shipment of oil to the other powers, which would be a very powerful place to be. In that sense, it reminded me of Vietnam because the U.S. wanted to get into Indochina, which it had not occupied before. That had been the French. And they wanted to set up bases, and they wanted to circle China. This was before any fighting or anything. So I thought, well, they want to get into Iraq and set up bases. I had already found out that, you know, that they were going to set up permanent bases and then take on Iran and Syria and possibly have a position of influence in the oil world. I didn't really understand that the U.S. economy was in such bad shape even then, and that actually, and I'm jumping a little bit, the U.S. got involved in Iraq from a position of weakness, not strength. And one example of that, which is widely unknown by Americans, and I'm finding that even more now that I'm on this book tour, which is that it's just not known that in November of the year 2000, Saddam Hussein switched from the petrodollar, from dollars, to euros, with the European countries asking them to pay for its oil in euros. And so what that meant was that the oil for peace, the
oil for food,
oil for food money was transferred, was redenominated, as the word goes, into euros. And that was not so advantageous to Iraq right away because the dollar was not in such bad shape in the year 2000. But within a year or 2 years, it started to plummet. And the value of the former dollars that Iraq had shot up so that $10 billion in the oil for food became 26 billion euros. Those are hard figures. Now, this was carried on Radio Free Europe. You know, this was the closest to the U.S. and in the Asian and in the European press. Not, as far as I know, in the U.S. press. Of course, there must be exceptions, but I have not heard it. And there are online sources of people who know this. And of course, as I said before, European and Asian press. So this really devastated the U.S. I think this was a subject for Dick Cheney's energy meetings. This is one of the reasons why he has not released the subject of those, the energy meetings with Enron and with the big oil companies in that they carried out right after the elections, before 9/11. I'm sure of it. And there are even hints in the stuff that's been released that that's true. So I think this was very devastating. It was not the origin of the U.S. interest in Iraq, however. You know, that goes way back, or at least 10 years back. At least in 1992, we know that that was on the agenda then, on the neoconservative agenda anyway. But this fact was devastating, not because the money was so great, or that one, although that, of course, that was the second largest. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world, so that's significant. But it was as a precedent for other countries in the Middle East, especially in the next year when the dollar started to fall. And in fact, Iran was discussing this. The other axis of evil country was discussing this, and Venezuela was discussing it. And Venezuela, which is a member also of OPEC, carried out various procedures which were similar but different. They started to barter their oil. This is all in this book of mine. They started to barter the oil, and they worked out deals with, like, Cuba, where Cuba would send in medical teams that would be set up, and they would get oil in exchange and things like that. And then now, 2 years later, inside OPEC, Iran, Venezuela, and Indonesia are raising the issue of switching from the dollar to the euro. And, of course, the oil crisis that's going on right now is not at all a crisis for those countries or for the oil companies. But this is even more devastating to the EU. This would be pretty awful. I mean, it would make the Depression kind of, well, it would be like the Depression. And it would be international, like the Depression, because petrodollars are the reserve currency of the world. And, of course, OPEC has voted not to do this now, not to follow those three countries. And I don't think they would go it alone, although I don't know. Iraq did. So this has put the administration in a position of great, is very nervous-making, shall we say. And we don't hear any of this. I mean, we hear all this stuff about democracy, and I don't know what we hear as a justification for the war now. We're just there, and we have to keep up our side of the bargain, and as the resistance gets greater, we have to fight all the more with less troops. Mm. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible, and very sad situation, the American military situation in Iraq now. But so that economic fact, which has to do with oil but also with currency, is very, very basic to the motivation that got the U.S. involved in Iraq. Long answer.
You would think in this country, in terms of corporate media focus, which tends to be somewhat tunnel vision on a lot of topics, one of the things we regularly get on every half-hour news blurb is how the stock market's doing. It's kind of like Americans are inundated with some economic info. Yeah. And I mean, that's our whole drive. I mean, it's economics. Right. Yet something as critical as this to stay off the radar screen is kind of surprising.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And yet, to answer the question of why has the debt increased so much, both the trade deficit and the budget deficit, you need to have this kind of information. I mean, really, to account for the seriousness and of the U.S. economic situation internationally, you need this information. And there's even more having to do with what U.S. multinationals are up to now, which I don't know whether we want to go into that. This is not in the book, but it's certainly anticipated, and in a general way it is in the book. It was the New York Times on the 27th, very few days ago. And it's about major multinationals parking their taxable profits offshore, which is not new. I mean, we know Enron did that, and Enron is up for that right now. Sometimes it's not illegal to do that. Sometimes it is. I won't go into the differences. This money is parked in Ireland and in Bermuda. and it's the pharmaceutical companies and 41% of American manufacturing, which really floored me. That's a quote. J.P. Morgan's Chase study said that the United States manufacturing sector accounted for 41% of unrepatriated earnings, which means it's not taxed. We have no benefit from it. That's just staggering to me. I'm not an economist, and needless to say, that's why I'm kind of talking about it in non-technical terms. But this is very, very basic stuff. And they would behave this way because, for the bottom line reasons, because profits are their business. And to shelter their profits from U.S. taxes is a good thing for them to do. Now, we are all familiar with outsourcing as not a good thing for U.S. markets and for a source of money for, say, Social Security, Medicare, and so on. But this is new, this to me anyway, this is new. And the scale of it is new. So I think, where is the money going to come? If these corporations are taking their profits, and the profits of their foreign subsidiaries, which is maybe less surprising, and keeping them overseas, or parking them where there's very little tax.
Well, maybe they see what's happening to this country, which is in large part due to what they are doing themselves, and they're planning on getting the heck out.
Wow, I hadn't even thought of that myself. I don't know.
But sticking with the idea of what corporations are doing or getting away with, corporations appear to be plundering what's happening in Iraq currently. I mean, they're going over there and getting these total sweetheart, no-bid deals. And even as damning as that is, what they've been presenting to the public and what they've been doing, or in this case not doing, doesn't seem to be getting the attention it deserves.
Well, that they're plundering the reconstruction you're talking about. And Order 39, which was under Bremer, Paul Bremer, we don't hear about him anymore, that doesn't exist. And there are not, that plundering and the no-bid contracts sort of came to a stop because of the resistance, because of the insurgents in Iraq. And so I think the only companies that are over there are oil companies and Halliburton and Bechtel. But even Bechtel, which was involved in restoring electricity and water supply and sewage and so on, in some schools, they're out. They're not doing much anymore. And, you know, recently when we heard that what remained of the $18 billion that was given to Iraq for reconstruction, well, it was never spent, actually. That wasn't spent because that required a certain amount of supervision, which apparently Bremer never did. I mean, it was really a no-bid. He would pick up the phone and say, I think I got something for you. That was the way it worked. I mean, it really did. And they never really got in most of those companies that were lined up for reconstruction, except the biggies, except Halliburton. But to the degree that they did, they didn't function. I mean, there were some businesses working in hospitals. I remember reading quotations, and I can't remember the names of them right now. And they were horrified with what they saw, you know, and whether they accomplished anything, I don't know. But more recently, in the last couple of months, Bush said, we have to switch over what we were going to spend on reconstruction, which wasn't the whole $18 billion, it was $8 billion or something, and switch over to security and training of Iraqi police. Remember that?
Yeah.
And that was testified to really what reconstruction was all about. And it was phenomenal to realize that there was so little that had actually been done, which was revealed in those figures. That's a contrast with Vietnam. I mean, in the early part of Vietnam, there was much more talk about nation building. And it was delivered to a degree in the South. But this reconstruction was nothing, really, but creating a free market, not fair market, economy in Iraq that the U.S. and other countries, to a degree, but mainly the U.S., you know, could repatriate their profits home. That was the first element of Order 39, as it was called, that Bremer brought out. But as I say, it's gone now. It didn't last. So you sort of wonder, what have they gotten out of their investment, the Bush posse? You know, not very much. And they have these bases that are permanent. They have made bases. Apparently, according to Kerry in the debates, there's 14 there. 14? I didn't know there were that many. I mean, bases to last, not just temporary ones. So they still have some hope of running some kind of show from that. And those bases haven't been attacked, as far as I know. And they probably are... they're probably in the desert. They're not near the cities. They probably will be at some point. I mean, it's not where the fighting is going on right now.
Right, because they have the bulk of their troops are around areas like cities. Or they're using
well, they're sent out from there. These bases right. occasionally. And, well, right now they're in Seder City there's and Samara. There's an attack in Samara, which will be followed by the Iraqi police and the Iraqi... the Iraqi military being put in there, and they'll last just a few days. They'll either join with the insurgents if they aren't already in cahoots, or they will leave because they're not going to be able to stand up to that. And that's so obvious that to anyone who's following that. And you wonder, you know that there have been announced real attacks that are coming on those Sunni cities, those cities that are part of the Sunni triangle, as opposed to the Shiites, right after the elections. And that's going to be bombing from the air, as in Vietnam, you know, to minimize casualties.
U.S. casualties.
U.S. casualties, yeah, and maximize Iraqi casualties. Oh, well, I mean, certainly the farther away they are from the source of the bombing, the more casualties there will be, and they'll have less concern even than they do now.
So, you covered Vietnam fairly closely.
Yeah, I did. I went to North Vietnam during the war.
A lot of people have made comparisons, obviously, between Vietnam and what's currently happening in Iraq. Do you see a lot of parallels there yourself, and or do you see it as even worse than what was done in Vietnam?
Well, it's much worse. In the beginning, I saw parallels, and I think the first chapter in this book is called Vietnam Redux. It brought me back to Vietnam, and I really thought about, and it's very seriously about Vietnam as well as Iraq. I thought about various things in Vietnam that I didn't understand at the time. It's an interesting chapter, but this is not like Vietnam, no. It's not a serious war. I mean, I hate to say that. Of course, the deaths are serious, and the losses are serious, but it's just not... And you wonder the military resistance to the civilian Pentagon, which has been running the war, is, of course, very great. And every once in a while, not recently, but every once in a while, we have, you know, very violent charges by military commanders just recently out of the service, I mean, retired from Iraq. And that's in this book, too. But I have great sympathy for the military. I wonder why they haven't first stood up to Rumsfeld, who's a micromanager and an autocrat. You know, he's absurd. And why they've allowed... Vietnam was a failure in the end because the only strategy that the U.S. had was escalation. And it's sort of true now here. But we don't even have that because we're not sending over more troops. And Rumsfeld doesn't want to send more troops. And the U.S. military budget is going in huge amounts to military systems that have nothing to do with asymmetric war. In fact, the budget for the war has been cut back to meet the budget for basically Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and their weapons systems that they've been able to pass through Congress, of course, because of the pork involved. The training has been cut back, U.S. training of the military. We know this, but we didn't know why. This is another recent development that's come out in the U.S. press and in the British press, in Financial Times, the London Financial Times. So there's been a cutback in training and in... restoring equipment, which we know about too, the lack of armor, the lack of sufficient armor for American troops. It's actually been calculated in order to save money. And so why but to pay for these huge weapons systems that are coming down the pike that don't have anything to do with Iraq? I mention things like that because that stuns me as much as I have a history in this. I mean, with Vietnam, I'm stunned by the carelessness of that decision that the war is really not even being promulgated as a serious war. So where does that leave the military? And I'm not close enough to it to be able to speculate.
What we're talking about here, in some ways, with the exception of the war in Iraq itself, a lot of these are policies that have been happening for a long time. We're looking at gentle curve of, for instance, the direction of the military-industrial complex, the tack of corporations getting more and more power. That's been happening a long time. It's been obviously in the current administration, all this has been ramped up significantly.
Right, exactly. That's right.
Do you think
that's what this book is about? Actually, it's the fact that, say, over the last 30 years, this ramping up, as you call it, has been going on. Even Carter, you could say, it's in a sense, it started under Carter, and he certainly declared the Middle East his, you know, a problem for good reason then, and a vital interest to the U.S. That was his phrase, which it always has been, or for a long time, and certainly is. And I think the role of corporations, of oil companies, and of Wall Street corporations, banks, international banks, and telecoms and so on, these new multinationals, which some of them border on criminal behavior and others have slipped through, are hugely important in this war. Not the war in Iraq, but the domestic economy. It's as if Bush has tailored his economy to the elites of these companies. These are some of the same companies that are parking their money, their profits overseas. It's not even favoring U.S. capitalists, you know, if you want to use that old-fashioned word. So what is it all about? It's an international economy. Carlyle Group is probably the epitome of it, which has no home base at all. It's an international economy, and it picks up the international leaders, John Major from Britain, Prime Minister, and everybody that we can think of, including Colin Powell from our side, and the former president of South Korea, whose name I can't remember, and so on. They're all the members of the Carlyle Group, whose interest is in primarily defense, but also many other businesses, and it's in finding places to invest their money, their collective money. It's like a giant hedge fund. And then people who are a member of the Carlyle Fund will profit from it. And so for years, for the last I've been following it for about 4 or 5 years, the Carlyle Group has been very active in trying to get into Russian oil. And they have been taking a beating over it because, you know, one of their member corporations wanted to get into Russian oil by way of Yukos, which is of course has been attacked by Putin most recently and may not even exist, and that's another subject. But they were willing to put up with a lot to get what they wanted, which is a long-range view, access to Russian oil. And Russian oil is very, very plentiful, potentially, has a huge reserve also.
So do you think that if there's a change of administration come January of next year, that is going to radically change the direction that this country is heading in?
No, because the companies we're talking about give less money, but they do give some significant campaign money to the Democrats. And the Democrats are feeding from the same troughs as the Republicans are. And that's been true for I don't know how many years. It's certainly been true. Well, it's been true for a number of years. I think, of course, it's very important to vote for Kerry and to get Bush out. I mean, he should not be allowed to occupy that White House. It's absurd. But Kerry is, you know, his foreign policy is not different in any way from, I mean, not significantly different. And in some ways, there was an article today in the New York Times, today the
October 4th.
Okay. By William Safire, saying, is Kerry the new neocon? Yes, because his military policy on Iraq has much more bluster to it than does Bush. That's true. That came across in the debate, too. But basically, he doesn't have a solution to Iraq, I don't think. I mean, he doesn't have a way to prevent the U.S. just from staying in there and slugging it out.
Or his policy on Palestine-Israel is pretty much the same as Bush's
yes,
as well.
Yes, that's the same. That's the same. And that's critical to what's going on now, right.
So yeah. What do you see then? You said you believe people should vote for Kerry to get Bush out. Then what do you see as long-term solutions?
Well, this is a good question. I'm supposed to have the answers to that according to my publisher, but I really don't. Just because I was very involved in 60s activities doesn't mean that I do. I think we're up against a long battle. People do not realize that. And if for some reason Bush is elected again, you know, it'll have to do with the electoral system, and it'll have to do with the Electoral College, and it'll have to do with Diebold Company and the voting. I mean, I don't think then the motivation for Americans to look more closely at these issues I've brought up, which seem tangential to the military issues, will be much greater. And then at the same time, if Kerry's elected, the opportunities will be greater, maybe, for questioning the fact that a debtor nation is trying to run an empire, which is what it's all about. In Vietnam, it was... I mean, there were people who saw it as a larger issue, but people were trying to stop that war and bring the troops home. Those were the relevant slogans, bring the troops home. And, of course, there were so many troops to bring home, and there were so many who died. 58,000 died. So, and it took 10 years. Well, we're at the beginning of this. But what are we going to do, rearm the U.S. empire? I mean, are we also going to try to, are we going to deal with these companies that are parking their money offshore? Well, that's globalization. And I think one thing we're going to have to deal with that we didn't really have to deal with in the 60s is security. The attempt to control the behavior of Americans who are in opposition to official policy is one thing that is pursued on a very, or there's not much resistance to it. Of course, there is resistance on a legal level, but there's not that much resistance. Seattle was, of course, the last really successful demonstration. I mean, successful with a lot on the part of the anti-globalists or the anti-globalizationists and the security forces. But I think it'll be much harder to take action in the streets. So I have a feeling there'll be a lot of different kinds of actions. I'd be thinking about this for the first time, which is always risky. But I think there will be a lot of different kinds of actions, and I think it'll be very international, much more so than it was. And we already have experience in that. We can do that. And of course, email helps a lot, the internet helps a lot, just as it does big corporations. It helps the movement too. Already the number of protesters for the Iraq war was greater in Rome, as we know, greater in London, the two countries that were with the United States officially. The resistance was huge, bigger than it was in New York. So we'll have that behind us. We'll have that international force behind us, I think.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
We've just been talking with Carol Brightman. She is author of the book Total Insecurity, The Myth of American Omnipotence.